Because communism was an ideology, its rebuke had to come in the metaphysical realm. Writers such as Adam Michnik in Poland, Georgi Konrad in Hungary, and Václav Havel in Czechoslovakia all had rejected communism and articulated a moral vision opposing it. In comparing the works of these three writers, the British historian Timothy Garton Ash discovered strikingly similar elements. He writes in his book, The Uses of Adversity, I quote, "All three reassert the fundamental premises of Judeo-Christian individualism. They begin not with a state or society, but with the individual human being, his conscience, his duty to live in truth, and his right to live in dignity. First, change thyself," might stand as a common motto of their work. All three of these writers affirmed a fundamental principle of ethics, the conviction of the value of sacrifice. They affirmed that there are causes worth dying and suffering for. They affirmed the ancient truth that ideas matter, that words matter, that living in the truth has profound implications for those who live around you. As Havel put it, the main pillar of the system is living a lie. And for that reason, anyone living in truth posed a fundamental threat to the order. Because the totalitarian system was based on rigid uniformity, every moral challenge to it threatened to unravel it from within. One candle forces a great deal of darkness to recede, and one changed life, for that reason, had a disproportionate effect on the moral landscape of each of these countries. There was something unique about the experiment of communism. For the first time in history, man attempted to eradicate God fully, claiming that he held all potential within himself. Communism drew followers as fanatic as the religions that communism abhorred. Whitaker Chambers, who knew the compelling attraction of both, claims that two faiths have been on trial in this century, faith in God and faith in man. Communism is a manifestation of the latter. It is, in fact, man's second oldest faith, Chambers observed. Its promise was whispered in the first days of creation under the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Ye shall be as gods. The communist vision is the vision of man without God. To understand Marxism, you have to understand that it is an ersatz, secularized religion. It borrowed the Christian vision, but stripped it of its transcendence. Marxism adopted the biblical ideals of peace, the sharing of material wealth, freedom from oppression, promising that these would mark the end state of man and his perfection. One view is based on the materialistic view of man, the other on a spiritual view of man. It's no coincidence that Marxist ideology was hostile then to Christian faith. Communism was not casually agnostic. It was aggressively atheistic. Both Marx and Lenin were exposed to Christian teaching in their youth, and they both rejected it deliberately. As a teenager, Karl Marx wrote essays about Christianity with such thoughts as, and I quote, "The unity with Christ gives an inner elevation, comfort in suffering, quiet confidence, and a heart open to love for mankind. All that is fine, all that is great, because of Christ." He was abruptly to change his attitude. And in his 20s, he penned the well-known dismissal of religion as the opium of the people. His father, Heinrich Marx, uneasy at the developments that he saw in his son, wrote a letter to him. I quote from his father, "I wonder whether the peculiar demon to which your heart is manifestly a prey is the spirit of God or of Faust." Vladimir Lenin was the son of a devout Orthodox, but he broke with religion at the age of 16. He wrote soon thereafter, "Religion is one of the forms of spiritual oppression which everywhere weighs heavily upon the popular masses, crushed by their perpetual work for others." Lenin threw down the gauntlet in a 1913 letter to Maxim Gorky, claiming God is, and I quote, "filth, prejudices, sanctification of ignorance and stupor on the one hand, and of serfdom and monarchy on the other." This is not indifference to God. This is a declaration of war. It's impossible to understand Marxism without the light of religious consciousness. Robert Nisbet and many others have written about this. I quote from his book, The History of the Idea of Progress, "Such a view is regarded as heresy or nonsense by many, even today. But from the time Marx took over Hegel's dialectic and the belief in the necessary, inexorable development toward a single, inevitable, golden end, Marxism, despite its pretensions to and rhetoric of science, was fundamentally a religion, end of quote. Communism was prefigured by medieval millenarianism. As Norman Cohn put it in his fascinating book, The Pursuit of the Millennium, this millenarianism advocated communal property and the abolition of private property. It engendered fanatic followers who used drastic disciplinary measures and widespread executions as a way of imposing their vision. They claimed that in order to bring on the perfected state of man at the end of history, that you had to essentially eliminate the disbelievers or convert them, which in practice meant annihilating them largely. Likewise, violence in the name of an ideal has become the hallmark of the false religion of totalitarianism. I'm certainly not the first or the only person to document this peaceful revolution as a manifestation of that conflict between faith and communism. George Weigel and Oxford's Timothy Garton Ash have written incisively on this conflict in Poland and Czechoslovakia. Kent Hill and Michael Bordeaux have chronicled similar developments in Russia. There's a growing body of literature documenting exactly this thesis. People who resisted communism because of their faith rejected a worldview which clashed with their understanding of truth. There were certainly many people who resisted for moral reasons who were not people of faith. I don't dispute that for a moment. But the moral leaders of these countries were significant because they led a revolution of the spirit which preceded the political revolution. These people were willing to risk their lives for their integrity, and they challenged totalitarianism at its roots. They were, however, obligated to use different weapons. Only days after Solidarity advisor Father Jerzy Populescu had been murdered by the Polish secret police, Adam Michnik said, "Let these methods remain theirs alone." Solzhenitsyn put it this way, "Those who choose error as their principle must use violence as their method. Those who choose truth as their principle must use peace as their method." The moral leaders of this revolution were committed to using peaceful means. They set the tone, they pled for nonviolence, and they motivated others to stand with them. And as they stood, one tree at a time, this forest of awakened consciences grew. Together they experienced fruition of the promise, "The truth will set you free." After such a spectacular liberation, one would have hoped for a happier ending. That not all countries have flourished since, I believe, does not refute the story of how they were freed. Liberating slaves and teaching them the personal virtues to live in freedom are two very different tasks. Generations of dependency have sucked out the substance of the children of communism. Most of the moral and the spiritual leaders have very little political influence today. The attempts to rebuild these countries have focused on the material needs without acknowledging the moral devastation, which is at least as significant. Corruption has flourished. The habits of the heart and the mind change very slowly, and it will take longer than a generation to undo the damage. When communism collapsed, a lot of people in the West were very self-congratulatory. But Solzhenitsyn has remarked that Russia is not embarking on democracy at its healthiest phase of development. At precisely the moment that we in the West are involved in transferring the institutions of democracy in a market economy, few here possess the spiritual virtues which make their practice fruitful. The 20th century has lived off the cultural and spiritual heritage of the West and handed it back depleted. The fruits have been consumed, the branches snipped, the roots long forgotten. Now the West is rushing to transfer material wealth to the East, but few here are aware of their own spiritual poverty. A closing word. The people who lived under communism had to make many decisions we have not. I don't know if I would have been willing to have sacrificed the educational opportunities for my children or my career for my political or spiritual beliefs. I hope so. I think we only know that at the moment of decision when it comes to us. I don't know if I would have willingly gone to jail. I hope so. I don't know if I willingly would have died for my convictions. But I honor those who did. And I'm stronger when I think about their strength. The kind of character forged in the crucible of communism is striking. Perhaps the examples of these heroes of the peaceful revolution will give us moral courage in our own moment of trial. The formation of spirit is like the formation of coal in the earth. Eons of pressure over time create either dust or diamonds. Thank you.